when I was just a little girl.
And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast. Rich,
here's what she said to me. Que sera, sera, whatever will be, the future's not ours to see. Que sera, sera.
Here at Quark's, customer satisfaction is our primary concern.
I'd say we just found our way into a wormhole.
I'm Kira Norris.
Lieutenant Commander Worf, reporting for duty, sir.
You're the best crew any captain ever had. This may be the last time we're all together.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. And for Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
It is quite simply, Commander. The journey you have always been destined to take.
Sensors are not functioning.
You've lost all contact with the space station.
What the hell is happening out there?
Shields up. Damage report.
Battle stations.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Listen to the prophets. A Deep Space Nine Two True Freaks presentation with Sean Engel and Andrew Layla.
And now with 100% more Paul Spataro.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another thrill-packed episode of Listen to the Prophets, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast hosted by two true freaks. And by thrill-packed, I mean not at all, as today's episode deals with trade negotiations and stories about killer clouds. Yeah, no, we're not talking about the Phantom Menace or John Carpenter's The Fog, although that would be really nice because it allows us to talk about Adrian Barbeau. Ow. But both these movies have been covered by various shows on the network. No, today we're taking a look at Storyteller, or The Storyteller, an episode that almost succeeds in making Dr. Bashir not completely annoying. I did say almost. And as always, I am joined by my Dalrock battling buddies, Mr. Andrew Leyland. Hi, Andy.
Hi. More Dalrock than Dalrock.
Exactly. And Mr. Paul Spataro.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good night, depending on when you're listening. But if it was up to me, I wouldn't tell the story. I'd go back to bed and let the Dalrock do what it wants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think we're going to have as much positive. I mean, last episode, I was the sort of positive one, but I think I'm going to be kind of pulling a 180 on this one as well.
Well, now, don't you be counting no chickens, dude.
Okay, well, we'll have to see how everyone... Because, like I said, we don't share notes or share our opinions of these before the shows. We may give hints, but yeah, I don't know what Paul or Andy is going to say, and neither of them really know what I'm going to say before this, so it's all up in the air to what everyone else's opinion is on the show. So that's what makes for some interesting conversations.
And you know what I've taken to doing is I have my list of our rankings of the episodes from the beginning to now that I've maintained, and what I'll do is when I watch the episode I write my ranking in under my column before we even start to speak. So at the end of the episode, because I don't want it to be something where I didn't really have an independent thought and I'm just kind of following along with the crowd. So I want to make sure I've already formulated that opinion before we start discussing and influencing each other. That doesn't mean I'm not open to you guys changing my mind, but anytime I give a number, it's the number I came up with before the show, unless I specifically qualify it by saying I was going to give this a such and such, but you've convinced me otherwise. And I'm just looking at the rankings, and I think as somebody who generally likes most things that he watches, I think I've been the most negative of the three of us.
I've got it pulled up in an Excel spreadsheet where I've actually got the columns averaged out. And so far for this season, the average ranking for Andy is a 2.66 repeating. So 2 2/3 bars of gold breast latinum. For myself, I'm a bit higher. I'm a 3.08. So mine's about a 3, so I'm a little more positive. Paul, your ranking is a 3 or is a 2.625.
So, okay, so I'm not that far below.
No, you're pretty close.
But I am the lowest.
You are the lowest, but out of 3 people being, the lowest, that's not all that difficult. And it's not like you're like a 1.7. I mean, and you've had some very positive things to say about the opening episode, about Emissary, about the Negus. You had some good things to say about past prologues, so you're not completely down on the show, but
I love the show.
but
I'm trying to rate each episode individually, you know? So
but like most first seasons of the Star Trek The Next Generation shows, there's some ironing out to be done, and we've had some ups and downs, sometimes a bit more down than usual, but I've been still pretty impressed with how well this show has held up over all these years.
I was thinking, and I wonder what you guys think about this, but we're probably just past the halfway mark on season one.
Mm-hmm.
When we finish each season, do you want to do one episode kind of looking back on the season before we move on to the next?
I think we could probably do like an extra long episode. You know, when we do the season finale. Well, yeah, the final episode of the season, and just kind of give a overview of the season, how we felt that it built upon itself, if it did, or you know what our opinion of the season was. I wouldn't be opposed to that. I don't think we need to do a full episode simply because that's going to add another month and a half to our 6.5 year series that we're going to be doing here. But I'm fine with that.
All right, that's fine. I can live with that. Okay. I do want to do a slight retrospective, but I think we can build it into the episode. That's fine. We don't have to go off and make it a grand review. So anyway, since the last episode, anybody got any new Star Trek news?
Has there been any since the last episode?
I don't know.
at the time of this recording, it's interesting. Last episode, we talked about characters that Jonathan Frakes was thinking about directing, or possibly being looked into, and by the time this comes out, we'll probably already know who's going to be the director of the new Star Trek movie. I saw on Facebook at the time of this, so this will kind of date where this episode has been recorded, I think today is the anniversary of the release of Star Trek Insurrection, which was the second movie that Jonathan Frakes directed. So that's kind of Star Trek news. Other than that, yeah, I got nothing.
Well, just in honor of its anniversary, I find that Insurrection is generally put down. What do you guys think of it?
I like Insurrection. I really do. I don't see what everyone's problem with it is. Some people have got valid criticisms about it, just like they have valid criticisms about Star Trek the Motion Picture. It doesn't stop me enjoying the film.
You know, what I just in retrospect, Insurrection came out around the same time as The Phantom Menace, and I have a recollection of speaking to one of my friends before either one came out, and says, "Well, the one thing we know is that the Star Wars one will have some great character moments and be a thoughtful movie, and you know, you don't know where Star Wars is going to be, Star Trek is going to be." And ultimately, when it came out, it was exactly the opposite. The Star Trek movie was so much more into character and less, you know, into the grand space opera stuff. And the Star Wars one was totally space opera. But I look back on Insurrection and I look at some of the criticism, and I think it's a flawed film. It's not a great, great movie by any stretch of the imagination. But it has in it a lot of the things that people are criticizing the Abrams movies for not having. And yet, it's totally put upon, because there are a lot of character moments, and there is some science fiction in there with the planet, where you don't age and you slowly develop, and they kind of explore that and how that has affected their society and everything. And I think, you know, a lot of that is really well thought out and well done. And yet it's the one that gets so criticized, or it's one of the ones that gets so criticized. And I just kind of think people will criticize because they can. And I really think that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, I agree entirely. I think Insurrection has an awful lot to say about our, and Hollywood specifically, obsession with youth. And I think it's like you. I think it's flawed. I don't think it's perfect. I don't think it's the best of the Star Trek movies. But it pisses all over Star Trek Generations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people have said that Insurrection is like a two-part Next Generation television show just put on the big screen. And I think that's an apt description. I think, however, my problem with it is it's a two-part Next Generation episode put on the screen. If I'm going to see a major motion picture, I'd like to see something a bit more cinematic. I can go to Netflix now and, go watch back episodes of Star Trek Next Generation. Or at the time, I could have gotten one of the tapes, maybe gone to the library and gotten one of the tapes of Next Generation and watched it. But there's really nothing awful about it. I mean, I think the next film that came after that, Nemesis, was significantly worse than Insurrection. And yes, Generations was perhaps the low point of the Next Generation movies, but there's nothing that really offends me with Insurrection. I think you nailed it, Paul, saying that a lot of times people just want to criticize things. They're not happy with just saying that it's enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. I also think something is said, and it gets repeated enough by the louder members of the fan community, that it starts being accepted as lore. Because I was reading something just yesterday, I can't remember for the life of me what it was, that said Star Trek the Motion Picture was a bomb, which could not be further from the truth. For the longest time, the motion picture was the highest grossing of the Star Trek movies. But it seems to become accepted law that because people don't like the film, that translates into the film did not do well. And that kind of fan think just permeates everything nowadays. If enough people say it loudly enough, it starts to become accepted as reality. And one of the realities is that Star Trek Insurrection sucks when it doesn't. It's not great, but it's not bad by any stretch. It's an entertaining Star Trek movie that at least has, or at least attempts, to say something interesting in a way that doesn't insult your intelligence while it's saying it, which was one of the problems I had with Into Darkness. Not that it wasn't trying to make a social comment, because it was. It's that it failed in trying to make that social comment. Whereas Insurrection just raises the questions and lets you mull over them if you want to. Or if you want to just enjoy a movie where Worf gets a zit on his face, well, it's that as well.
And that's where I always find it to be kind of funny that I have the lowest ratings on things, because I'm not even totally 100% down on Nemesis. And I'm sure that puts
me in
the huge minority. But I have some entertaining things in there.
Yeah, sorry, I was having a coughing fit again. The only Star Trek movie I think is absolutely appalling is Generations. I think that's even worse than JJ Trek. I really do. I need to do an episode about Generations and get that out of my system, don't I?
Oh, do a palace on that. See if you can.
Yeah, I was thinking. Well, I was thinking of doing a palace on all the odd numbered Star Trek movies.
They have,
because everyone talks about Rafa Khan and Voyager Home, don't they? Tell you what, we will do that. The three of us will get together and do that. I don't know when.
I would love to. They have not made a Star Trek movie that I don't like. And that may be, I'm like I said, I think I'm in the minority, but I found something in every single one of them that I can enjoy. I thought Chris and Scott did a commentary on Generations. And I thought they came up with something that in my mind was brilliant and would have really just given the movie a little bit more depth, was that when you go to Kirk, when he's in the Nexus, and the woman calls to him, it should have been Joan Collins from City on the Edge of Forever.
Peter David postulated that as well in one of his columns. He was basically like, well, she's a big star and she wouldn't have done it. And he said, no, she's a working actress in the Michael Caine mode. You get in touch with her agent, you say, we will pay you this much money for 3 days' work, she would have done it.
Yeah, and I think it would have been brilliant. I think that really would have just given, like I said, so much more levels to his fantasy world.
And it would have made his reason, it would have made him wanting to leave this even more difficult, because you get the idea from City on the Edge of Forever that Edith Keeler was the one for Kirk, and if he had to give that person up rather than just some randomly named person, that supposedly he fell in love with, it would put more, I hate to use the word, it put more gravitas on Kirk's being in there.
Absolutely, it would have made it so much more understandable, and it would have given you the understanding of what he was giving up to go and help Picard.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, and, well, even and, if and it, to die by falling off a bridge.
even just having it be Miramani or Carol Marcus, you know, somebody the audience gives a damn about.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Carol don't Marcus, give a toss I don't think, about I think, Antonia.
I think Carol Marcus wouldn't have been right because he left Carol Marcus again anyway in the series of movies.
I know, but just somebody the audience would get that he cared about.
I would have liked Miramani, I would have said.
Yeah, just a woman's name in the long list of women that Kirk's been with. It's like, who gives a toss?
Yeah, you never actually saw the woman. You could have even just said it to Edith Keeler on the horse, because you never see her. All you see is like a silhouette.
Mm-hmm.
And hear a voice.
Well, and
they never even had to get Joan Collins.
But yeah, I think they would have just put in some mention of it being Edith, and the fans would have got that. The people who know Star Trek would have understood, and it would have added so much to a mediocre film. It would have elevated it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But speaking of things that need to be elevated and tossed away, let's get to our episode today. Are you guys ready for this?
Absolutely.
All yep. Right then.
According to the majority religion, the Force will rise against the people.
The Dell Rock wakes!
Is it alive?
Only the chosen one will have the power to stop it.
If he dies, we all die.
Now O'Brien has been deemed their last hope.
Bloody hell!
And against his will, becomes their new savior.
Without your protection, it will kill us all.
There's been a serious misunderstanding.
On the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
This one was The Storyteller. It was the 14th episode of Season 1 of Deep Space Nine and aired on the week of May 2nd of 1993. It was written by Kurt Michael Benzmiller and Ira Stephen Baer and directed by David Livingston, had the regular cast accompanied by Aaron Eisenberg as Nog, K.E. Cutter as Sarah, Lawrence Monsoon as Hogarth, wow, that's odd, no, Hobarth, Gina Phillips as Varys Sewell, Jim Jansen as Farron, and Jordan Lund as Woban. And the synopsis, again, of course, comes from the Star Trek Deep Space Nine Companion, written by Terry J. Erdman and Paula M. Block. As Sisko plans his opening strategy to help defuse a potential civil war between two rival Bajoran factions, O'Brien faces a potentially unpleasant encounter of a more personal nature, a medical mission to Bajor that pairs him with Dr. Bashir. The two men depart in a runabout, and the commander and Major Kira head for a docking bay to meet with Varys Sewell, the leader, Tetrarch, of the Paku delegation. Because the Paku avoid contact with outsiders, Kira explains that she knows little about the Tetrarch, and she is surprised at Sisko to discover that the leader is a 15-year-old girl. They soon discover, while Varys is young, she is as tough and stubborn as her opponent in the dispute, Woban, the gruff leader of the Nabat contingent. Sisko's attempt to bring the two together for an informal discussion of the issues they must resolve quickly falls apart, and Varys storms away from the proceedings. In the meantime, O'Brien and Bashir arrive at their destination and are met by Farron, the village magistrate. Although they've been advised that the entire village was in peril, they discover that only one man is ill, the Sarah, who serves as a spiritual leader to the people. Bashir quickly determines that there is little he can do for the Sarah, who is dying of old age. Alarmed, Farron explains that the Sarah is needed to protect the village from the Dal Rock, a terrible creature that attacks for 5 nights each year at the end of the harvest. If the Sarah cannot face the Dal Rock on this 4th night of the cycle, the village will be destroyed. Back on the station, Jake and Nog spot Varys in the promenade, and the Ferengi boy is immediately infatuated. He convinces Jake to help him meet her, and the two soon show up on her doorstep and attempt to befriend her. That night, against Bashir's advice, the Sarah goes to the village square to face the Dal Rock, which appears to be a large, threatening energy cloud. Of course, it's clouds. Curiously, it doesn't register on O'Brien's tricorder. As the Sarah tells the story of the Dal Rock, strange, storm-like conditions begin to whip the village. The villagers respond as a unit to the Sarah's words, and as he speaks of their strength, a white light arises from the villagers, pushing back the Dal Rock. But then the Sarah collapses, and the Dal Rock begins to rage anew. O'Brien and Bashir rush to the Sarah's side, and the old man tells O'Brien how to finish the story. O'Brien repeats his words, and the Dal Rock is driven away, after which the Sarah dies. Aww. To the cheers of the crowd, well, not the death of the Syrah, but to the cheers of the crowd and the befuddlement of the two crewmen, Farron declares O'Brien the new Syrah. On the station, the negotiations between the Paku and the N'Fot are not going well. Varys refuses to give up the land that Woban's people claim is rightfully theirs. When she shares her frustrations with Nog and Jake, Nog suggests that she could turn the problem into an opportunity if the N'Fot have something that she wants in trade for the land. In the village, O'Brien attempts to figure out a way out of his predicament. He has no intention of remaining on Bajor, but he can't leave the villagers defenseless. And in any event, he has no idea how to prevent the attack of the Dal Rock. When he tries to speak to Hovath, a young man who served as the late Syrah's apprentice, Hovath attempts to kill him in the most awkward manner possible. Hovath knows that O'Brien is not meant to be the new Syrah, he is. Calming Hovath down, O'Brien and Bashir learn that the Syrah's bracelet contains a piece of one of the orbs of the Celestial Temple. By using the power of the bracelet under the guise of storytelling, Syrahs over the years have periodically channeled the villagers' fears into the manifestation of the Dal Rock, and similarly their thoughts of hope and into the defeat of the beast. The spiritual has served to unite the villagers, Hovath explains, but only the Syrahs have known this secret. Hovath was in training to become the new Syrah, but his uncertainty during an earlier encounter with Dal Rock allowed several people to be injured. Now the people's lack of confidence in Hovath prevents him from taking over as the Syrah. That night, O'Brien awkwardly tries to tell the story in the village square, and although the Dal Rock appears, he cannot control it. As the villagers begin to panic, Hovath gains confidence in himself and steps forward to calm the people and tell the story. He succeeds in banishing the Dal Rock, and O'Brien gratefully relinquishes his title. At the station, Varys suggests an exchange, free trade access in return for the land. That seems that it will work for both Bajoran factions. As she prepares to leave, she thanks Nog for his advice with a kiss on the cheek. Okay, go.
Well, as you were doing your synopsis, I thought of the title for this episode.
All right, hit me.
Que sera sera.
Oh, very clever.
It's a little bit more old school than a lot of the titles we've gone for to this point, but that one just occurred to me now. I don't know. This episode, you have two really kind of... It's not even like a plot A and plot B. It's kind of like equal plots. Like, I don't see one as a subplot so much. It almost struck me as they had two different ideas, and neither one was worth doing an episode on, so they decided, let's just combine them.
Yeah.
And that's the way it plays for me. It just seemed like, you know, just the episode's there. It's nothing about it that I found engaging. I found both stories to be lacking in many, many ways. I thought the O'Brien story was just kind of uninteresting and dumb. You know, that this village has got this, you know, they have to pretend that there's a danger there. These people were occupied by the Cardassians. You have to pretend there's a danger there to unite the villages. It just really seems kind of stupid. I can understand where when the Cardassians leave, you might need something to unite the village, that they might start falling into a little civil war type thing like the subplot has. But while the Cardassians are occupying them, I don't see where they should have any issues at all being organized and being, you know, united. The Dal Rock animation, I guess it's computer animation, just seems so cheap. It looks like Terry Jones should have done it on Monty Python.
Yeah, the little energy tendrils do feel like something that do feel very Monty Python-esque. It's, you know, we've commented before about Odo's morphing effects not holding up. This really looks bad. I think it could have been, you know, if they're going for a cloud effect, why didn't they go the tried and true route and do the sort of Flash Gordon movie thing where you just pour some sort of liquid into water and film it in slow motion and get the effect like that? Then they could CGI in the little cloud tendrils, but yeah.
Yeah, so that's the storyteller aspect of it that I just found to be lacking. And then you combine that with the other story where I thought there was some potential there, maybe, if it had been written well, but I thought the characterization of this young girl was very, very poorly written. She goes from being this ultra serious, take me serious, I'm 15 years old, but I'm, you know, I have the abilities of an adult, and you better, you know, you better take me serious because I'm not giving in, I'm tough, to, hey, let's play a trick on let's play a trick on Jake, and act like a 15-year-old girl. You know, I don't think you turn it on and off that quite that quickly. And that's the way they showed it, and you know, the again, I thought they missed the shot for subtlety in the transformation, and they bludgeoned us over the head with it. As I understand it, this is another repurposed Next Generation script, and I think they did a poor job of adapting it. I think they just kind of it smacks of being rushed a little bit. The only thing about this one in particular that I found to be compelling was I liked the way Jake talked about his dad. I found that to be like the only real character moment involved. And I liked that his being so positive about his dad led the girl to trust him more, even though she really didn't, you know, he didn't really factor too much into the resolution. But that said, I just thought this was a negligible episode that we really just never needed to see.
Okay, Andy, do you want to give your opinion?
Yeah, I really liked this one. No, I genuinely liked this episode.
Okay.
For one, yes. There is an element of, yes, this is a Next Generation repurposed plot that didn't seem like it had enough to justify it being a full episode, which is why it was rejected. It was originally a first season Next Generation pitch that didn't become an episode. And when they were scrabbling around for plots for Deep Space Nine, Michael Piller remembered this and asked the writer to redo it. But whilst the central plots, or A and B plots, or co-plots, or whatever you want to call them, aren't really that different from anything that we've seen before, they do actually do an exceptional job with the characterization, which I credit to Iris Stephen Burr, who did a page one rewrite on the script. The Nog Jake stuff is great. Really well played by those two actors. Yes, the actress playing what's her name, Gina Ferris, playing Varys Sewell. Yeah, Varys does suddenly become likable in the last 5 minutes of the show because she has to become likable. But the actress does as good a job as can be expected, given that her story arc doesn't really have an arc. She starts off as a bitch, and at the midpoint of the episode, she suddenly becomes likable as you start to understand her point of view. But it's largely because she's never been allowed to be a child, and being allowed to just goof off with Jake and Nog and get herself into trouble. I mean, the scene in the middle of the episode where they get caught in Odo's office trying to steal his bucket and Jake's covered in oatmeal was genuinely lovely. And it's these two kids who have got through to this world leader when sitting down around the diplomatic table and talking didn't get anybody anywhere. Then you've got the Bashir an O'Brien subplot where we finally see the start of O'Brien and Bashir becoming best mates. For the first time, Julian's actually quite agreeable, because how he treats what's happening to O'Brien throughout this entire episode, he treats it as being stupid. He knows this is silly, and he loves every minute of O'Brien's discomfort. And for his part, Cole Meany plays the hell out of that. He doesn't want to be there. He just wants to go home. As far as he's concerned, he's only there to be a pilot for Bashir. He wasn't even meant to be there today. And they play that magnificently. And the Jake relationship with Ben is wonderful. And just the characters carry it through. And the characters have earned it an extra gold press latinum. mark when we get to the end and we give our results. Because although the main stories are a bit blah, all of the characterization in it is great, and I really enjoyed it.
Okay. I'll have to fully agree with you on the first part. The characterization of the girl who has known nothing but having to be a ruthless leader trying to defend her people against, you know, against an opposing force that wants to retake the land that supposedly they have claim of. You know, the fact that her parents are dead and she's been forced upon to be this rough, difficult, hard-nosed leader has not allowed her to be a kid. So, but when she finally gets to interact with two people who are actually her peers, initially she was doing it specifically because she knew Jake was Cisco's son, and she thought she could have some advantage over him because of that. But when she actually started interacting with him and realized, you know, that she was a kid herself and that she didn't always have to be this hard-nosed bitch, it allowed her to sort of free up and be accepting of trying to negotiate with these people. My opinion of the second plot, yes, I'm glad we see the beginning of the relationship between Bashir and O'Brien. It just smacked of early 90s Bill Clinton-esque political correctness. I know it's a while before the Hillary Clinton book It Takes a Village would come out, but this really smacks of that sort of silly groupthink that I just really can't get behind. Like, okay, everyone, if we all think positive thoughts, everything's going to be okay in this village. And, you know, it was a stupid, stupid subplot, and it brought down that portion of the episode. I thought the interaction between the kids was really great. Seeing this young girl who's known nothing but having to be a hard-nosed leader finally get to not really cut loose, but, you know, be around people her own age and interact like a child was really nice. I thought the idea of this village that has to fight a fakey, orb-induced villain from, you know, that's a gas cloud was just,
it was Galactus.
Unconscionable. Oh, don't even besmirch the greatness of Galactus.
Well, I'm talking about from Rise.
Yeah,
of
from Rise of the Silver. Well, again, you know, not to go off on a tangent, but there was, if you watch the scene at the end of it, there was a kind of shadow that could have been Galactus in the cloud. But yes, Galactus. Yeah,
I struggled so mightily to see that because I wanted Galactus up there with his big purple short pants.
Yes. And the G on his belt. Was it on his belt or was it on his helm?
I think it was on his belt.
Okay.
Much like Apocalypse had an A on his belt.
Mm-hmm.
Because these people forget their initials.
Well, you know, and it's branding. You know, it's one of those things. You know, you brand yourself and you got to put the G on there so people know, oh, Galactus. I get it.
Well, you know, it would be funny if they did something where, you know, they play off Man of Steel and somebody says, oh, you got a big G on your belt. Where I come from, that's the symbol for despair. Anyway, back to Deep Space Nine. I thought I had interrupted you, Sean.
Andy,
I think you hit on some good points, and Sean, you as well, about the I think what this episode could have used is, instead of having co-plots, which is the way I saw it, now I didn't pay close attention to the amount of screen time they each got to see if it's actually equal. But I think had they given the reins to the station story about the negotiations and her interacting with the children, it would have given them more of a chance to be a little bit more subtle with her transformation, because it just never struck me as real. It just never struck me as genuine. And I think had they given it a little bit more time to develop, it might have, and then that might have given that story a little bit of resonance that I felt it didn't have. And they could have ignored the stupid Dalrock story, and you know, and again, I like the fact that they're finally making Bashir into a real person to some extent, and they're not making him quite as dislikable. But you know, I just think, again, you know, it's just missed opportunities. I think they could have done well with it. One of the things I noticed that I kind of like, and I had never really noticed before, is Nog has this strange cadence to the way he speaks. And I always kind of just found it a little bit disturbing, but now I'm kind of watching it as more along the lines of he isn't from this culture and he's trying so hard to fit in that he's thinking carefully about every word before he says it. And that just adds a little bit more depth to his character that I like. And it adds a little bit more subtlety, or I don't know if subtlety is the right word, but it just adds a little bit more depth to the performance as well. And I'm pretty happy with that. I think that is definitely a missed opportunity, because I think that could have been... I think it was okay in the way they presented them, but I think it could have been superior. And this is kind of two episodes in a row that I'm thinking there's missed opportunities.
Yeah, I'll agree. There are definitely things that they could have done to better promote both stories. I enjoy the plot more, specifically of the one with the kids and the girl, you know, trying to overcome the fact that she's had to be this sort of hard-nosed leader, and then eventually getting to realize that you don't always get everything accomplished just by being negative or being obstinate. And it took, you know, Jake and Nog, two people who were her peers, to teach her that.
Yeah, but again, like I said, I think if they had dedicated a little bit more, you know, maybe take 5 minutes from the... From the O'Brien Bashir story and give that to that the trade negotiating story, for lack of a better title for it, I think it would have allowed things to develop a little bit more cleanly and organically, instead of feeling so forced, which is what it did to me. I don't think you make that transformation in the blink of an eye the way that she did. I think she should have been a little bit more hesitant to join them in their hijinks. And should have, you know, kind of gone there more unwillingly, and then kind of saw, hey, you know what, this is fun. I never got to have fun in my life, and I never realized what it is. I think you should have seen a little bit more of that revelation and transformation in her character. Now, I know she's a throwaway character that we're never going to see again, but if we're dedicating an episode to her progression, and by doing so, developing the characters of Nog and Jake further, I think her storyline, her story arc needed to be just a touch more believable. And I think, like I said, giving it a little bit more time and letting it develop a little bit more slowly would have been a better way to do that.
Well, I wouldn't have minded if they took a lot more away from the Bashir and O'Brien storyline, because that was the thing that just the whole it takes a village feel of that just really annoyed me.
Quite honestly, they could have eliminated that entire story and just had something where O'Brien and Bashir were going on a trip together, and when they left, you could see O'Brien's disdain for him, and you gave a couple of minutes to just show how he kind of earned a little bit of respect for Bashir, or that Bashir, you didn't, because they didn't really do that, actually, so let me change that. They didn't really, by the end of this episode, Bashir really hadn't done anything in particular to earn O'Brien's respect. It was more along the lines that we got to see that Bashir wants O'Brien's respect. I think they could have just shown us that, and that could have been the entire story arc for the two of them. We didn't need to have the Dalrock or the village at all.
They could have done just simply like the opening teaser, you know, the opening thing where, you know, O'Brien's uncomfortable of going on this trip with Bashir, and we see them leave, and then we, at the end of the thing, we get a little wrap up, and we see them coming back, and they're, you know, they're a bit more chummy, they're a bit more comfortable with, and it's left to your imagination what went on. Maybe they describe a little bit what goes on, but it's seeding the idea that they're going to become good friends.
Yeah, I would have gone with, you know, make it a true B subplot, not, and in fact, if anything, this is the one the episode's titled for, so, you know, this is considered the main storyline. I would have made it the real subplot. I would have had them leaving on the trip. I would have had the scene on the runabout where he's like, you know, you can call me Julian and all that. I would have left all of that intact. I would have, you know, that they're going to pick up some supplies or some bullshit like that. And then, you know, when they get there, somebody gives them a hard time and O'Brien has to kind of step up and, you know, Bashir helps him somehow. And you don't even have to have that they're chummy, but you've just seen that Bashir is, you know, that he wants O'Brien's respect and that he's working for his respect and he's not just a pompous ass.
Yeah.
And that would have been enough. That's all you needed to do with them. You could have eliminated every other aspect of that plot in from this episode. And then it would have allowed them the time to dedicate more time to the trade negotiations subplot and her subtle epiphany about, you know, being more reasonable and being more childlike and not being a hard ass all the time. And then, like I said, through that, develop the characters of Jake and Nog a little bit further. And I think it would have been a far superior episode to what it was.
Mm-hmm. Who would have thought, you know, we would have enjoyed something about trade negotiations?
Enjoy's the wrong word. I like all the Nog stuff. I like them sitting with the legs dangling. I think Odo was brilliant in this episode, even though he's barely in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, he had some great lines. I especially love that at the very end, you know, he takes them away. They get punished for, you know, what they did. You know, you're going to clean this office until it shines. That's great. They didn't get away, you know, they didn't get away with this prank without having some consequences for it. So I enjoyed that.
Yeah, and I like that Cisco's behind them being punished for it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Have we exhausted this one?
Yeah, I don't think there's much to say. You know, I think if they would have focused more, I was more interested in the Jake, Nog, and Varys storyline. It was nice to see O'Brien and Bashir sort of start up their relationship, but the whole idea of them having to go down to Bajor and the stupid storyteller thing. And okay, the one thing that I will like about it, the awkwardness at the end where O'Brien is trying, okay, everyone, let's all give it our best shot and we can do this, you guys are good, come on, we can work together. You know, just him trying to stumble through it was amusing, but the rest of the entire storyteller plot just galled me.
Did you not like the ending though, when they picked the new Syrah and O'Brien was like, right, let's get the hell out of here now? He's not interested in seeing how it all turns out, he just wants out.
That was okay.
Yeah.
But you know, you hit on it in the synopsis, and I don't know if it's in the just the synopsis that you read or you added it, but the fact that it was the most lame possible murder attempt, you know what I mean?
Clearly,
the guy's heart wasn't in it.
No, I added that. That was another awkward thing. The what's his name?
The new Syrah.
The Hovath. Yeah, Hovath came in there and tried to assassinate him with a knife. And both Julian and O'Brien were trying to hold him off. And he's this guy who's got to weigh like a buck 50. And, you know, is just this wiry little skinny guy. And two of these Starfleet officers can't defend themselves against him. It was just silly.
Yeah, it was. And even the fact that after that murder attempt, instead of, like, you know, either beating the crap out of the guy or throwing him in the brig or something, they're like, hey, why'd you try and kill me? Really? That's your reaction to it? Come on. I would have taken that knife and turned it around on him if I had the ability.
Well, at least get a good couple of Kirk punches. That would have worked.
Drop kick, maybe.
Oh, yes. There's not enough drop kicks in Deep Space Nine. There need to be. See, I'm waiting for season 4 when the Klingons show up. Then there's going to be tons of drop kicks all over the place. Okay, I think we've said all we can say about this one. Have we?
I'm
yeah,
done.
Pretty much.
Okay, who wants to go first with their?
Oh, I think I'm the most negative, so I'm going to jump in first. I thought the storyteller plot was totally negligible, didn't need to be in there at all, as I've just explained. And I think it sucked away whatever quality that the subplot or the secondary plot had, and took away its potential to make this a real positive episode. I found this to be, quite frankly, often I found it boring. This is one where I might not stick with it if I was flipping through the channels and it was on. I'm giving it a 1.5. I was not happy with this episode.
Okay. I'll go ahead and go next. I'm a little... I enjoyed the plot with the kids. I will admit, yes, the turn of Varys from hard-nosed leader of this group of people that's been constantly fighting at this other group of Bajorans was a bit quick. I think it could have done well to have a bit more of the plot deal with that character, but overall I considered that plot to be the more enjoyable one, and the plot with Bashir and O'Brien on the planet to be just laughably awful. It was basically an average, like a 3-episode brought down by the storyteller part of it to a 2-bar, a Gold Press Latinum episode. So 2 bars for me.
I'm not going to disagree with you about the plots, but I love the characterization and the acting. 3.
All right, then. Well, Paul, according to my Excel spreadsheet, Paul is still the lowest average of here, but everyone's ranking is above average. So for a first season show, the fact that all the shows we've had have been above average is pretty impressive. Well, that's it. No, I don't want to talk about this anymore. Let's move on to email. Do you want to go ahead and do that?
Yeah, okay.
Okay, I will go ahead and pull up the email. We've got one here from Gene Hendricks, and this one is about the Law and Order episode of Dax. And he's got it entitled Dax and a Rant. And Gene writes in, Andy, Paul, and Sean. So Paul's in the middle this time. Andy's first, so there you go. Sorry, Paul.
It's a step up. Usually I think I'm third.
But I'm certain Gene is thinking about rotating names around so no one gets offended. So he's a good guy like that. He writes in saying, okay, let me get this out of the way, a.k.a. get ready for a get-off-my-lawn rant. Since you were talking about Abrams' Trek at the beginning, what's wrong with a new set of characters for Star Trek? Why do we constantly, in fan films, fan fiction, comics, and movies, have to keep going back to the original crew? I agree with Andy that adding Shatner to anything immediately improves it, but I'm kind of sick of it. After Star Trek VI, those characters retired. Yes, the new crew has come. Yes, the new crew has some really good performances, mainly Bones, but those characters in my mind are tied to the original actors, and it would be easier for all concerned if they were left alone. If you want to set your Trek in the original era, fine, just pick another ship. There are plenty of them out there. But I'm asking for originality from a group that said, we have a clean slate and can do anything we want in this reality. Let's do a remake. Truly a facepalm moment, at least for me. Let's go ahead and address that portion of this. Do you think the Abrams Trek would have been better if they wouldn't have gone with the original series cast or the original series characters?
I don't think it would have been any better or any worse. I think they were just playing it safe. I honestly think you think of Star Trek, you think of Kirk and Spock. They've gone into this film to want to make as much money as possible because it's a tentpole picture for Paramount. It isn't really Paramount anymore. It's CBS. They don't seem to have the same respect for Star Trek that Paramount had. Well, yes, they referred to it as the franchise and the Golden Goose, but they still seem to have some idea of what it was about and what it was in its original incarnation, whereas the new guys just seem to want to be out to make science fiction blockbuster, and everything that they make nowadays has to have a brand name or a franchise title, and hey, we own this thing called Star Trek, let's make it into that. I think if they really wanted to progress the series, they'd give it to Ronald D. Moore and make it another television show. And yes, then set it in the 25th century or the 26th century or whatever, and just move forward from there. But that's not what they're interested in doing. Mm-hmm. They're interested in making a product that is recognisable and people recognise, no matter who they are. So let's put Kirk and Spock into it and let's look backwards instead of forwards, which isn't what Star Trek's about. Star Trek should never go backwards.
But, you know, I understand and I don't disagree with what you're saying, but it's not as if they haven't done that. I mean, we have The Next Generation, we have Deep Space Nine, we have Voyager, and to some extent we have Enterprise that are bringing us new characters and are bringing us people in the Star Trek universe that are not the original cast and crew. This is an attempt to revive the original concept because people like familiarity. You know, familiarity breeds contempt, but familiarity also draws people to the box office. I think having seen what they did with Daniel Craig and James Bond, I think they thought, you know, we can mine that same type of thing and do something with it. And you know, I've enjoyed the two Abrams movies. I haven't hidden my opinion on that. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely things they could have done better. I just don't know if they had done it with a new crew, if it would have had the built-in audience that it did. I think the two movies that have come out have had a greater box office despite the internet criticism, because there are people who aren't huge Star Trek fans but kind of like it, and they're willing to go and see it because it has the characters that they're somewhat familiar with. And you know, ultimately you do have to fall back on the thought that this is a business decision that they're making, and the box office is pretty important to them. And if they decided, you know what, we're going to go with Peter David's New Voyages and try and see if we can make a movie series out of that, I don't know that it would be successful. I really don't. And I'm not saying, and I haven't read those stories, so I can't even give a critique as to the quality. I'm not saying they're not good stories. They might be wonderful stories. I really don't know. But I don't know that they'd be box office successes, because I don't know that people would want to try and learn these new characters. And it's different from saying, here's a new science fiction franchise you've never seen before. They'd still be coming out and saying, hey, this is Star Trek. But it's Star Trek with new people. So what you'd be doing is you'd be having those less invested fans saying, I don't need to do this because it's a new crew and I don't want to see it. And you'd be having the people who have an aversion to Star Trek, and they are out there, people who feel that Star Trek is geeky or nerdy or whatever, that they would be avoiding it as well. And I think the box office would suffer because you'd really probably only be pulling in the more hardcore fans. So I don't know that that's a good business model. Now, for a TV show, I think it is. But for a movie franchise, I don't.
Yeah, I think you hit it there with that specific comment. For a TV franchise, for them to go with a new set of characters, a new direction, a different timeline, or even set it in the old timeline, set it in the time where Kirk, Spock, and McCoy were around, but just a different crew, I think that would work fine on a TV show. The movie is an entirely different thing. You only get one big shot for 2 hours to tell a story, and that's not what that's necessarily what Star Trek, or it's not what Star Trek is. Star Trek has been a long-form TV show. The Next Generation had 7 seasons before they went to a film. Granted, the film was Generations, which, you know, I think we voiced our opinions on that. But the thing is, that's the same thing that worked with the original Star Trek. They had their season, they had their mythology built up through the TV show, and then they went to the movies. If we just put a new crew and new characters out and just called it Star Trek, and you had really no connection to the past or to who these characters were, I don't think it would work as well. Star Trek... What would have been better, in my opinion, would have been if Abrams could have taken the same characters, the same ship, taken the money for the first movie and spread it out over a TV show, over, you know, say, you know, 30, even if it's just doing like the AMC type run and doing 13 episodes or whatever. Do that, make an interesting show, tell interesting stories, and I think people would be more receptive to that. The fact that you have a big budget film, you have to try and get in as many people as you can. So them having to mine the original characters to try and bring people in is understandable, but it is also kind of weak, the fact that, you know, it doesn't seem like they're moving forward.
Well, I think also, is Gene not addressing the idea that they could have gone anywhere after that first film, the one from 2009, and instead they elected to just bring back Khan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly what he's talking about.
I think that's more symptomatic of the mindset than anything else. They could have done anything after 2009, and they said, let's go with the thing that people recognise, which personally I think is creatively lazy. But that's just me. If you've come to Star Trek and J.J. Abrams' movies are your Star Trek, then I'm not going to sit here and say you're not a fan. You know, if that's your version of this show, then fair enough. Fair play to you. But from a creative decision, I think Into Darkness was lazy on every conceivable level. It's not that I thought 2009 was bad. I didn't think it was great, but I didn't think it was as good as other people did. I just thought Into Darkness was like, I just thought it was lazy. Let's put Khan in. Everyone knows Khan. That's all they were interested in doing. I think Star Trek's heart is on television.
Exactly.
I don't think any of the movies, any of them, have ever captured what made those original 79 episodes brilliant. And I'm not saying all 79 were brilliant, but nothing that came after ever captured that feeling. Nothing that came after ever hit the highest highs of the original. Nothing ever hit the lowest lows either, but that's going to happen when you're being bold and when you're being daring and you're going to do something different. And I think the only way you're going to get that back in Star Trek is to give it to somebody like Ronald D. Moore and say, make us a 13-episode Netflix series and let's see what happens.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is that CBS has a relationship with Netflix. I mean, CBS, you know, the reason all the series of Next Gen and Deep Space Nine, Voyager are on Netflix is because CBS has a good relationship with them. So, and Netflix has shown that they can put out quality, you know, quality programming on their own. House of Cards, you know, got nominated for a ton of Emmys. I think even won some. They did the Arrested Development show, the Marvel shows that they're coming out with. So,
yeah. I do think that you could do more with it. But my understanding is the reason that the book series set in the Abrams universe was cancelled and the reason that they're not having discussions at the minute about a TV show is Abrams and his crew have basically said, no, this is ours at the minute and we don't want anyone else fiddling with it. Hmm. But Star Trek has proved it's bigger than one man.
Yeah, I agree with largely what you've just said. And I think the funny thing is one of the movies that comes under the most criticism and fire is Star Trek The Motion Picture, which I think is the one that comes closest to the spirit of the original TV series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, go on.
I was going to say, Gene and Scott did an episode on the Hammer podcast where they highlighted that show, and I thought they did a nice job of explaining why that it's kind of wrongly criticized in a lot of ways. Yeah, you know, I do understand that there's certain points where it's a little slow moving and that, you know, that might bore the audience a little bit if they're not totally invested in it. But I happen to really enjoy that movie. And again, you know, I don't want to go along with the internet crowd. They want to criticize it and blast it and say that it's not good. I'm not on board with them. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Andy.
I was just going to say, Gene and Scott made the point that the motion picture is probably the purest example of Gene Roddenberry's vision. I would argue that, yes, that is, but also The Cage, the original television pilot, are the only two true examples of what Roddenberry wanted to do with it, because that's the only two times he was left alone to do what he wanted. And I think The Cage is one of the best ones they ever did. So...
I will have to say one of the things that really clicked with me in Gene's Hammer Strikes podcast, where he talked about the motion picture, was those long sequences of the Enterprise traveling through the V'ger cloud or this immense thing. If it wasn't this prolonged thing, it wouldn't sell the size of this thing that's coming towards Earth. It wouldn't give that sort of sense of dread that you should be getting at this immense, almost unfathomably large thing that's coming towards Earth, possibly wanting to destroy it. And I now that I think about that, the fact that it does feel overly long, if it was shortened down, I don't think you would have gotten that sense of dread. So I think you made a great point there.
I also think that, and this is coming, this is kind of stream of consciousness because I'm thinking it as I'm saying it, so hopefully it'll make sense. But when Star Trek The Motion Picture came out, and then it was out on video, when it became widely available on video in the early 1980s, most of us had TV sets that were probably 19 inches in diagonal. And I think although the show is most true to the spirit of the TV series, or the movie is most true to the spirit of the TV series, it is in its cinematography and in its presentation very, very cinematic. And I think that watching it on a small screen like that really didn't do it justice and helped to cement that reputation that it had. And I think in the current day and age where, you know, a lot of people have 40 and 50 and 60 inch TV sets, if they give that a new reviewing, they might have a totally different opinion of it.
Oh, I'll fully agree with that. Watching that on the big screen, you know, they mentioned also that it's a lot like 2001. It has that sort of big feel. And I can see watching it on your little 19-inch, you know, color TV and just standard definition, especially if it's not, you know, with the widescreen at the time, if it doesn't have the bars at the top and the bottom, you're not getting the full effect of it. You're not getting the grandiose feel of it. So, but we went on a big enough tangent. Let me finish up Gene's email. He says, okay, enough of that. On to a crew that is actually original. I enjoy Dax as a courtroom drama / investigation. The logo of Law & Order DS9 used for this one was spot on. Well, that's all Andy's doing, so congratulations. it gives us more information on the Trills in general, Dax in particular, and shows that Odo is more than just a peacekeeper. He's also an investigator. Yes, it was a foregone conclusion that Dax would not be extradited, but there were so many great character bits in here that I was willing to overlook that. I do have to agree with Paul that Sisko was not acting unethically or even being overcome by emotion, but was acting as a good defense attorney. His goal was to keep Dax on station, and everything he did was the same if Sam Cogley was representing her. Of course, having this judge and Cogley in the same episode would have been a critical mass of crotchety smartass. And that's, of course, from Gene Hendricks, the host of the Hammer Strikes podcast, the Quantum Cast, and Anime Freaks, all that can be found over at 2TrueFreaks.com. Go give them a listen. But, I guess that does it. I'm looking forward to the next episode. I'm hoping it'll listen, get us out of this funk. And Andy, do you want to go ahead and give us what we'll be doing next time?
Next time on an all-new episode of Listen to the Prophets, one half of Hardcastle and McCormick drops by. One of my favorite actors, Brian Keith, stops by Deep Space Nine.
Uncle Bill.
Yep.
Is that we out on that, or are we going to say goodbye?
Oh, we can say goodbye. Andy's going to cough his way out of it.
See you all next time.
Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.
We'll get you a lozenge.
It's been fun, guys.
Okay. Yeah.
Visit our website at 2TrueFreaks.com. 2TrueFreaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS.
You can email 2TrueFreaks directly at 2TrueFreaks@gmail.com.
2TrueFreaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search 2TrueFreaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find 2TrueFreaks on Facebook. Just search for 2TrueFreaks.
Dumbass.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about 2TrueFreaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Back. No, it's just not working today, is it?
No. I think there was probably just, you know, the way people handle themselves in the UK that would allow people like Eccleston or Alex Kingston.
That's it, Alex Kingston.
Yeah, to just go walk around and do generic stuff. Here in the States, we've got TMZ and all this, and even minor celebrities. Kim Kardashian.
She's not going to minor league ass, babe.
Well, that's
massive bottom. That's no moon.
It is a space station, and yeah, I'm certain many people would like to run that trench run, but
No, I honestly, in all honesty, I can't ever think that I would have got to the point where I would be bored of seeing a woman's ass.
Well, when you've got shows like, I don't know if you've heard about that. There's one about noodling. Do you know what noodling is?
No.
Okay.
I'm not sure I want to.
I can't. No, it's nothing perverted. Here in Oklahoma, what we have, we've got people who go fishing for catfish. However, they don't use poles. They don't use line or tackle. What they do is they go wade out in somewhat like waist deep or deeper water, stick their hands down in holes and pull out catfish, you know, grab them inside their mouth and pull them out. It's called noodling. And there's a reality show that follows people doing that. So I think we have scraped the bottom of the barrel if we are following people who do shitty, cheap ass fishing. Oh, we're missing Andy again.
I miss Andy whenever he's not here.
Damn the hell, Skype.
Yeah, all right, we'll wrap that up.
Oh, did we just lose him again?
I heard Paul say we never actually saw the woman. So no, we never did. Talk about Star Trek. No, I'm here.
Okay.
Oh, Jesus. I'm getting fed up of Skype today.
No.
Yeah.
We're almost done.